carrefour des arts. Broadcasted by Canal Academy. Listen to Kristallöck.
Balthus at the Pierre Janada Foundation in Martigny, Switzerland. It is a real event in the cultural field and is indeed a twofold event. First, it is the only important retrospective in the world celebrating the centenary of a major figure in the 20th century's art history, Balthus. And secondly, this is taking place at Martigny in Switzerland at the Pierre Janada Foundation, which chose the Balthus exhibition to mark the foundation's own 30th anniversary. The Pierre Janada Foundation was inaugurated in November 1978. And last but not least, the presence of Jean Clair in our studio of Canal Academy is also an event. Jean Clair is the commissioner, together with Dominique Radrizzani, of this exhibition in Martigny, and certainly the specialist of Balthus' work. And recently, in May 2008, Jean Clair was elected at the Académie Française, another event. Jean Clair, hello.
Hello.
And congratulations.
Thank you so much.
We are very happy to have you with us. Now, before we step into the secret world of Balthus, a more personal question. You're beginning a new career as becoming an immortal, as the members of the Academies of the Institut de France are called. Does it mean for you to change course, or is it just another distinction in a long list of decorations you already received to honor your important work in art history?
No, because it's not a distinction, because you become immortal once in your life. And forever, I hope. So it's something quite different from getting so-called Légion d'honneur or other chocolate sweets when you are getting old. But actually, I'm not yet...
Received.
So I'm in a kind of a limbo between the election and the reception. So it's a rather nice vacuum in which I feel now to be.
And you have all the time to prepare yourself to become immortal.
Exactly.
So today for this program, we won't elaborate on your life and career because we very much hope that you will come back to our studio for a special interview dedicated only to your life and accomplishments. So let's turn right away to our main subject, Balthus. And this retrospective in Martigny leads us to consider that all the periods and all the themes of his work are present. And can you guide us through the different stages of his life and the main major paintings of each one?
Yes. First of all, we should consider that Balthus was really kind of a unique example of a European culture. He was born in Paris, but his parents both were from German origin. His father, Erik Kosowski, was a painter, partly Polish and partly German. His mother, Baladine, was also a painter, partly German and partly Jewish. They came to Paris and worked in Paris. When the war broke out in 1914, of course, they were obliged as German citizens to fly away, and they stayed in Switzerland for a while, and Switzerland became the second country, the second fatherland of Balthus. That's why one of the reasons why he chose to come back to Switzerland at the end of his life, or the 20 last years of his life, when he stayed at Rossinière. And that's where a place in Switzerland, Geneva in particular, where his mother, when she divorced from Erik Kosowski, met a man of a certain peculiar importance of his life, Rainer Maria Rilke, the Austrian poet, who became his, in a way, second father, spiritual father.
Of Balthus.
Yes. And who wrote, actually, the first text ever written on him when he published his very first drawings of Mitsu, the story of a little cat, which he did when he was only 12 years old. And after Switzerland, to go back to his life of pilgrimage, so to speak, which he led, he went back to Paris, where his mother, Baladine, had a kind of a salon, which certainly was one of the very last salon littéraire of a very high intellectual level, where you could meet really the epitome of European intelligentsia, both French with the famous names of the so-called Nouvelle Revue Française, like André Gide, Grothuysen, but also writers from Spain like Unamuno or Suarez, also people from Germany like Thomas Mann, Germany, of course, like Kaiserling. So it was a kind of milieu, very rich.
Intellectually
very rich and totally cosmopolitan, in which Malthus grew up. Himself, he spoke
Many languages.
French, of course, but Italian, German, also English. He spoke superb English. And he was very proud of being, he said, the heir to Lord Byron. Somewhere in his family, Byron was probably one of his grandfather.
Yes.
I don't know exactly, but that's what he said.
He was very proud of his biography.
Exactly.
Yes.
And when he was in Geneva, he lived for a while in the Villa Diodati, where Byron also to live. And one of his very first masterpieces were the ink drawings for the Wuthering Heights for the Bronte sisters, which really is one of his capital seminal works, because some of these drawings were later used by him as the egg of a kernel, the beginning of most important paintings.
Yes. Like the Cassie, La Toilette de Cathy. Yes, which you find in a drawing before an illustration of the Wuthering Heights,
exactly.
Emily Bronte. Many times you find the same themes developed in his first designs and developed further later on in big paintings.
Yes, also because he used to work very, very slowly. So he prepared his paintings with an infinite number of drawings.
He was very precise also in the construction. So he moved from Paris to Switzerland in his youth.
Yes.
And he had Rilke as his spiritual father.
Yes.
And then he moved back to Paris. And then when did he leave Paris?
When he was in Paris, he made two very important trips. One to Berlin, where for a while he worked for Viktor Barnowski, the director of the Lessing Theater in Berlin. And it was a time in 1926-27 when the so-called Neue Sachlichkeit, new objectivity, was the acme of the avant-garde in German countries. And probably Malthus, who at the time was 21-22, was in a way very much influenced by this painting of very cold, very precise, very objective
character. Yeah.
Character, yes, exactly. Naturalism, also filled with stories of love and murder, violence and Unheimlichkeit.
Yes, the famous Unheimlich.
Unheimlich, yes, exactly.
Sigmund Freud,
exactly.
Yes.
So this trip to Berlin was probably very important. And at the same time, a year later, he went to Arezzo in Tuscany, where he made copies of Piero della Francesca, The Invention of the Holy Cross. This was the other direction, in a way, of his art. At the same time, he was under the charm, the spell of the so-called new objectivity, and at the same time studying very precisely, working under the fascination of the magic of the Quattrocento, Masaccio and Piero della Francesca.
Mm-hmm.
So we must realize how much Malthus was at the time, very young, at the core of what we call kind of a Mitteleuropa, half between Latin influences and Germanic influences, halfway between English and French tradition.
Yes, and strangely enough, it's in Switzerland, actually, that you find these crossings of the North and the South and Italy influence and German influence.
Halfway between Germany and Italy, halfway between France and Mitteleuropa. And also a country, Switzerland, where you can speak indifferently in French, in Italian, in German.
Yes, because when I said strangely enough, because normally you consider Mitteleuropa rather
a little farther east. Yes,
Poland.
He was Polish actually through his father and mother. But at the time, you may remember that it was rather difficult to go behind the Iron Curtain.
Yes, yes. So he moved back and forth. He traveled a lot. And at one time he settled in France.
Yes, at the time he had been living in Paris for about 15 years, not far from the house where Picasso used to live at the time, Quai des Grands Augustins. And in 1952 he decided to quit, to leave Paris because he thought the city was becoming too noisy and too heavy. So he went to kind of a whole castle without any comfort, without heating, without electricity, and in the middle of the poorest part of Burgundy, which is called Morvan.
Yes, and where he made some beautiful landscapes,
especially landscapes.
La Ferme de Chassy.
For example, La Ferme de Chassy.
Yes, which recalls a little bit, I think, maybe I'm wrong, Cézanne.
Yes, at the time it was very close to Cézanne and kind of very rigid, very strict construction of space.
But then France was still very actual in his life because André Malraux, the cultural minister, asked him to be the director of the Académie de France
in Rome,
the Villa Médicis.
Yes, it's very the Fortuna Critica of Balthus is very strange. I told you in the late 20s he was with his mother Baladine at the center of a very lively intellectual life in Paris. In the late 30s, his friends were essentially people like Georges Bataille, Michel Léris, Jacques Lacan, the psychoanalyst, Pierre-Jean Jouve, Antonin Artaud. Again, he was at the center of a kind of intellectual turmoil in Paris. At the same time, he was totally unknown. He was unknown from the general public. Nobody knew who was Balthus. And after the war, in the late 40s, he was not only totally unknown, but totally against the grain. It was the moment when abstraction, power, and the fact that Balthus was making portraits, landscapes, as in Chassy, street scenes, was something absolutely
incredible. For this time, yes.
So he was totally unknown, except by a happy few like André Malraux and the small cohort of very distinguished scholars and writers like Jouve, like Michel Léris and so on, who knew exactly the greatness, the genius of Balthus. So in 66, if I do remember well, or 67, Malraux offered him to take the direction of the so-called Villa Medici, the Academy of France in Rome, and there he stayed for 14 years. His main endeavor at the time was to restore the villa as it was in the 17th century.
He changed it completely.
Totally. But at the same time, he restored it. He restored the frescoes, he painted the walls, he fined the furniture and so on. And then he lived there for a while, and Villa Medici was really something absolutely the most enchanting spot to be in Europe.
A dynamic
at least in Italy.
Cultural center.
And also a very dynamic cultural center. Mm.
Yeah.
We're filling it.
He made this dynamic cultural
exactly, because
center,
he because was a man of also of entertainment. Mm. And he used to play, he was a player too.
And the theater and the opera.
Exactly.
And yes. Also Malraux sent him to Japan where he met his
second wife, Setsuko, yes.
Who is still Madame la Comtesse.
Setsuko Kosovska de Rola, still living in Rossinière, his last house on earth. And in the upper Switzerland, so-called Gruyère, between Montreux and Stade. And there he bought the greatest chalet in Switzerland.
Which is like a chateau.
Which is like a very huge chateau. And which was originally an hotel where the good English society used to go. It was the favorite spot of English travelers in the years 1870, up to 1900.
And he then could afford to buy it.
Could afford to buy it because the hotel did not work after the First World War for strange reasons. But the Englishmen, even very fortunate, did not like it any longer to go in such a remote place.
Mm. And meanwhile, he became a rather famous painter. And you took part, if I may say, to his fame. Because I forgot to mention that you organized already two very important exhibitions of Balthus. One at Palazzo Grassi in Venice.
Mm.
And another one at the Centre Pompidou in Paris. And you are the author of the Catalogue Raisonné, which I will find the translation of Balthus.
Catalogue Raisonné, I think.
Yes.
It was the latest to come, and when you are the latest, maybe you are the most fortunate, because there was a time, very long time, when Balthus did not want his biographers to tell anything about his life or about his art. So a kind of a curtain fell on his work for 50, 60 years. When I came, if I may say so, in the early 80s, he himself was not so reluctant any longer to oppose, to object to some people telling facts about his life, about his biography, about his career. So it was much easier for me to begin to write on him and on his life than it was for predecessors.
Let us now take a momentary leave of Balthus' intimate world in order to learn more about the man and the painter afterwards. You'll hear some movements of Monteverdi's Vespro della Beata Vergine. Monteverdi, one of Balthus' favorite composers. Jean Clerc, commissioner together with Dominique Radrizzani of this important Balthus retrospective at the Pierre Janada Foundation in Martigny, Switzerland, is with us at Canal Académie. So we would like to get better acquainted with the personality of Balthus, and first the painter, and afterwards then his life, his loves and his friendships. But as the painter, maybe we can have a closer look at some works of Balthus. With your help, Jean-Claire, which works would you choose to tell us about?
That's a very difficult question. First of all, he was obsessed with the idea of masterpieces, or the idea of making masterpieces in the 20th century. Looks totally silly, of course. Nobody is willing to make masterpieces anymore. He was willing. So some of his most important works are indeed masterpieces of rather large dimensions, with a topic, with a subject, with a history, which is also something very strange. Painting is not supposed to tell stories anymore, and he tells stories.
Yeah, he was a real storyteller.
He was a storyteller, and rather intricate stories. We were speaking at the beginning of Wuthering Heights, and probably Wuthering Heights was a kind of a key figure of what his concern, of his purpose. Telling stories, stories of love, stories of death, stories of violence, which he did. And from that, I think main pieces are, for instance, the first one which he did when he was 26, 27, which is called The Mountain, and which tells us about a love story of himself with his first wife, Antoinette de Vatteville, and among a landscape which could be inspired by some German or British painters of early Romantic period or late Romantic period, lakes and mountains. Another one is La Rue, the street of 1933, which is now hanging in the Museum of Modern Art in New York, which is a view of a topographical view of a certain quartier of Paris, Rue de Bussy. He lived very close to the spot, and which is a kind of a what we call tableau vivant in French, which is a game that bourgeoisie used to play sometimes, where the various guests are asked to
play a scene.
To play a theme, and at a certain moment, everybody stops, is frozen. We call it tableau vivant. And of course, this kind of very strange, a little unheimlich quality is present in the painting, mixing young and older people, including a kind of a sexual initiation with a couple of a young boy and a young girl.
There's even an anecdote around these two figures.
Yes, because at the beginning, the right hand of the young boy is placed on a more strategic point, the body of the young girl, and the man in New York who bought the painting, after a while, asked Balthus to remove the end and to put it a little.
So he put a skirt.
In a way, kind of a fig leaf, exactly.
In between the hands of the young boy,
exactly.
And the famous
innocence
lady
of the girl. And at the same time, the profile of the girl is exactly a copy of Piero della Francesca, the Queen of Saba. There is a kind of humor, hidden humor, in many of Balthus' compositions. which marks also the complexity of these stories which he tries to tell us.
And then the famous passage du Commerce Saint-André, which is like a parallel.
Yes, to la rue, to the street. 20 years later, the place is about the same in Paris. And it's also kind of a tableau vivant, mixing an old woman and an old man looking like a dwarf, Balthus himself walking, back view and holding a kind of a baguette, but it's a golden stick, similar to the one which is used in the fairy tales. And there was a lot of stories which we could tell about this very strange painting, which has nothing to do with surrealism. At the time, Breton was so much influenced by, so much under the charm of this kind of magical reality, that he tried to ask Balthus to be part of the surrealist movement. But it was, of course, a nonsense.
Besides La Rue, the street, or Le Passage du Commerce Saint-André, which you just were talking about, observing Balthus' paintings, you find several recurrent themes. Of course, you find women almost everywhere, languishing young girls, and cats, all quite erotic in their inspiration, aren't they?
Yes. Balthus himself made a self-portrait, the title of which is His Majesty the King of Cats. So Balthus considered himself as being a kind of a incarnation of the sacred animal called the cat, which one of the very few animals dealing with immortality, like Les Académiciens de l'Institut de France, because they are immortal in a way, because they are very silent animals. They don't speak, they just look, but they look very intensely. They are very inclined to sweetness and tenderness, but at the same time, they can bite and they can
scratch
very furiously. So there are a certain type of men who are very much attracted by cats.
Especially artists.
Especially artists and poets, like Baudelaire in Paris, who was a kind of a cat maniac, and so was Balthus.
Also Henri Cartier-Bresson.
And Henri Cartier-Bresson is a
close friend of Balthus.
A close friend of Balthus who liked cats also very much.
And you can find cats in many of his works, like, I don't know, like Thérèse Revan.
Yes, and also, of course, the cats are the usual animals who play a very specific and very crucial game and role in the fairy tales. In France, Les Contes de Perrault are filled with cats. Cats of very high importance, like Le Chaboté. And the same with the fairy tales of the Grimm brothers in Germany, and probably in England, you have many fairy tales filled with cats. Of course, Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll, fairy tales are filled with cats. The Green Without a Cat.
Yes.
Kind of a key figure of Balthus. And probably when Balthus was making portraits, he was always thinking of not of a physical portrait, but of painting a green without a cat. Kind of a ghost of a portrait, but with the presence and the heat, the warmness, the familiar animal.
Yeah. And there's one particular painting which is called Le Chat de la Méditerranée. The whole scenery about a big cat.
Yes, it's a self-portrait of Balthus, the same physiognomical aspect of Balthus' face. And he is eating a bouillabaisse because it's called La Méditerranée. It is still a very good restaurant in Paris, near l'Odéon, so very close to the place where Balthus used to live. And it was a restaurant at the time where people like Christian Bérard used to come. Also Jean Cocteau, a certain Parisian society.
Well, it's close to the theater of Odeon.
Oh, Odeon is just in front
it's
of
a fish restaurant.
It's a fish restaurant.
And the fish and the cats.
So of course, it go together very well.
Well, okay, they go together very well. One is the victim of the other.
Yes, well.
It is a very fascinating painting. Well, it's rather amusing.
It's a very amusing painting.
It's not in the usual style of Balthus.
No.
But then you have the Lever too.
Le Lever,
where
yes,
the cat is so important.
Exactly, and the painting, as far as I remember, is in Edinburgh, in the Scottish National Gallery of Edinburgh.
Edinburgh, which
super portrait.
Describes the scene of a young girl.
Yes, exactly.
With a wooden bird.
Yes.
And the cat is
fascinated by the young lady, half naked, and obviously there is a strange relationship which we can't tell of between the animal and the girl.
Yeah, and then, of course, we cannot ignore the languishing young girls in most of the paintings of Balthus. We talked already about Thérèse Révan, but
exactly.
That's a very erotic painting.
Yes, almost.
Even if Balthus says he doesn't make erotic paintings.
No, but obviously at a certain moment, especially in the mid-30s, he was provocative. He knew exactly what he was doing. You must remember that at this time he was a very close friend to Antonin Artaud and Georges Bataille, for whom sexuality and eroticism were key points of their works.
And besides the young girl, there's a very interesting construction between the young girl and the cat and the geometric construction of this scenery. Maybe we'll come back to some of his works, but we also would like to know a little bit better the man Balthus, his encounters, his friends, and his aims and the ambition or the quest of the man Balthus. Was there a quest?
Yes, where we talked about the will to make masterworks, to make masterpieces, the will to tell stories, which are aims very foreign to the general aesthetics of the art of the 20th century. But he was not alone to do that in the 20th century. You think of people like Beckmann in Germany, or if you think of people like Stanley Spencer in Great Britain. Also Spencer was willing to make masterpieces, to make large paintings, and also to tell stories. I think there is a great affinity between Spencer and Balthus. They never met each other, and probably Balthus never met Stanley Spencer. But I think of another English artist very close to Balthus, and who came to Paris in order to meet Balthus in 52, when Balthus was living in the Cour de Rouen, and this painter decided to stay in the Hotel des Beaux-Arts, Rue des Beaux-Arts. It was Lucian Freud. And Lucian Freud was a great admirer of Balthus in the 50s. And when you think of certain paintings of Lucian Freud, like After Watteau, inspired by Watteau, and telling a story about the life of Freud and the life of his daughters, you are very close to Balthus. So Balthus was not alone. He was not a kind of a falling star in a dark sky. He was actually somebody who were very much looked upon by a certain distinguished happy few who shared the same ideals.
Like Giacometti also.
Like Giacometti also was a very close friend. Like André Derain in France at the same time, said Beckmann in Germany, Spencer and Freud in England, and so many others. So he was not alone.
Yeah. Also all the poets, especially.
And of course, many poets, like Jouve, like Bataille in a way, Antonin Artaud, and Albert Camus, also a great admirer of Balthus.
And not to forget Malraux, who was so important in his life,
exactly.
Because he was the one, as we said before, who sent him to...
Yes, as soon as Malraux was nominated as a Minister of Culture, he was very effective on Balthus' career.
So his quest would be to create...
Masterwork.
Masterpieces, yeah. Besides creating masterpieces, there was, let's say, an aesthetic quest and a spiritual quest.
Well, the aesthetic quest would be, it's very strange to say that, beauty, looking for beauty.
Well,
in a time when we are almost 99%, yes, exactly. But very few artists in the 20th century have dared to say, I'm looking for beauty. They are rather looking for ugliness, for horrifying things, monsters. It's very strange the way that Balthus, for instance, at the same time admired Francis Bacon, and at the same time he hated Francis Bacon. He had a kind of a very double view on Bacon. He knew he was a great painter, but at the same time, could not bear to look at these monsters which Bacon was painting all day long, all night long. He was exactly the contrary. He was looking for rules and symmetry, harmony and beauty.
Very interesting figure. And just for the anecdote, what did he think about some of the abstract masters like Mondrian, for instance?
He knew that Mondrian had been a great painter when he was very young, and also one of the very acute eye to look at trees, for instance, and the studies of trees of Mondrian, the very early paintings, Balthus admired very much. But after a while, he said, now Mondrian wasn't unable to draw a tree. He was the main enemy of his proper art, and he felt very sorry about that.
Yeah.
He wanted to do exactly the contrary of that.
And he said, what a pity that poor Mondrian couldn't even look
at a tree anymore.
Trees anymore.
Exactly.
Because he had to paint something else.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, there's so much to discover around Baltus, but before, let us make one last musical break. Of course, Monteverdi, to please Mr. Baltus. Baltus, last part of our program with Jean Clerc, the specialist of this great figure of modern art, who is the center of our curiosity. Jean Clerc, you knew Baltus quite well, didn't you? So what personal impressions or anecdotes can you transmit us of your meetings with Baltus?
Well, I met him very, very late, if I dare say, because he lived very long too, but
93 years, yes.
93 years, so I met him not in the 30s, but I met him in the late 60s, in 69, at the Villa Medici in Rome, when I was preparing for him a retrospective of Giacometti's, of his friend Giacometti. So he was there at the entrance of the Villa Medici, half clad with a Japanese kimono and with sabots, wooden shoes.
Like the Dutch people.
Like the Dutch people or the Burgundian peasants in the 19th century in Chassy. So he was, as I discovered him later, a kind of a man who liked very much to play a role, to disguise himself, to be the king of a fantastic
mise en scène,
exactly. For which, of course, the Villa Medici was an ideal place.
He was the director of the whole theater.
He was the director of the whole theater.
He made the decorations.
Absolutely splendid, with the gardens and with night celebrations, of which the Roman, even today, still remember with stupefaction.
Oh, yes. Are there some documents?
Yes, many photographs, even films, which sometimes we should show.
It would be interesting to look at those documents of this time.
Also because it was a time when Rome was a very lively intellectual center.
Oh, yes.
With people like Moravia, who was living in Rome, like Federico Fellini, who was at the peak of his career. So it was a very interesting society.
And that was your first meeting with him.
It was my first meeting. I saw his painting for the first time in 66 in Paris, but I met him physically in 69. We met regularly, especially when he was in Rossinière in Switzerland. And he was not a very easy-talking and easy-going character. He was very diffident and sometimes very, should I say, cruel in his, how do you say, saillie, pointe.
Yes, maybe a little bit sarcastic.
A bit sarcastic, especially when he was in front of somebody very young, as I was at the time, and trying to explain what he was doing. Of course, he could not bear this type of... Afterwards, I decided not to say anything anymore on the meaning of his painting. And we began to speak about people we loved each other, and it was much better.
Yes, well, because you got to know him closer and maybe he became more confident, because maybe he was very shy inside, and that was his way to play the comediante.
In order to hide himself.
Yes, to hide himself, because his...
Permanent play.
His work, his paintings are
and
very
And he never accepted
secret.
Anybody in the studio. He never accepted anybody in the studio. Except maybe one or two so-called pensionnaires in the Villa Medici, young painters, but very few. We had the permission to go and see what he was painting.
What paintings did he paint in Rome while he was at the Villa Medici?
He painted the Turkish room, which is most strangest room in the whole villa.
No, but I mean as a painting. Did he have time to do some paintings also?
He painted a painting called the Turkish room from a room which existed in the villa. And which he did also. So he did the Turkish room as a place to live, and he did a painting out of the Turkish room.
I see. And it is still to be seen at the Villa Medici?
No, it can be seen in Paris at the Centre Beaubourg, at the Centre Pompidou.
Because I didn't see it in Martigny at the
No. Because it's a very fragile painting. Very strangely enough, many of Balthus paintings are very fragile and can't travel. That's one of the reasons it's so difficult to make an exhibition of Balthus art.
And so you went to see him a couple of times at Le Grand Chalet, Rossinière.
Yes, in Rossinière, till the last birthday, year before he died, because he had his birthday once every 4 years.
And he made a big celebration of his birthdays?
It was a big celebration.
Because he liked very much people around him.
Exactly.
At times, we can say, because other times
Once every four years.
To see anybody
yes,
else.
Exactly.
And so you said you met him at his last birthday?
Yes.
When he was then 92 years old?
Yes, he was 92 years old. It was both very...
A delicate moment.
He was obviously too much tired to take part in the festivities, also because his sons, which are part of the certain high life society.
His two sons, Tadej and Stanislas
Klosowski, they went there with singers like Bono.
Oh, yes, strange.
Strange, you know, exactly. And people from the fashion milieu. So it was a strange.
Very mundane.
It was very mundane, but also very old friends came because they knew it was for the very last time. So it was both, I don't say, mixed feelings.
Yeah. In your books, I consulted, of course, some of your books, and you can read a very sensitive passage when you went to see him at Rossinière, and you were looking both through the windows.
Yes.
And the windows reminded you of some Renaissance painters. They all had this little square.
Yes, a kind of a technical device used by Dürer and some Renaissance painters in order to see the reality through a kind of a grid, a mathematical grid. And so it was, small with this window.
And you stood there in
overlooking
silence.
The mountains.
Yes.
And infinity in the sky and the clouds.
Maybe that's a very strong...
Yeah, it's a very strong feeling. Balthus was totally lost in a dream. There was a cat, of course, a beautiful chartreux. I don't know how to say that in English, chartreux. And again, probably an angel came by.
And then you assisted at his funeral.
Funeral in January, under the snow. It was a very strange also moment, both very dignified and also a kind of... fantastic final play or game.
A little bit Fellini-like, no?
Exactly. Fellini-like, with the Archbishop of Wrocław, Breslau, all red.
Because he died in Catholic...
Yes, he decided to come back to Catholic faith, but with all the decorum of Catholic Church. So there was the Archbishop of Wrocław and with two of his acolytes, also in great red...
Dress.
Many people representing the French government and...
Painters' world, artists.
Painters' world, writers, poets, and it was very strange.
I can imagine all these
under
people
the snow.
Walking in the snow and in a procession
in this
going
very small village,
up the mountain.
Up to the mountain. It was a kind of a totally out-of-the-world feeling.
Well, let us leave him in peace. Yes. But another question before we have to separate. You were the director, Jean-Claire, of the Picasso Museum in Paris. Can you tell us some characteristics which unites them or divides them between Picasso and Balthus?
Well, they were about the same generation. They lived both very long, over 90 years. Picasso was very productive and Balthus was very little productive. Picasso left 40,000 works and Balthus more than 300 paintings. But they had very strong feeling of admirations towards each other. And at the time when Picasso lived on the Rue des Grands Augustins, a few yards from the studio where Balthus lived on the Cour de Rouen, they met each other and Picasso had an admiration for Balthus up to the point of buying one of the very early paintings of Balthus, Les Enfants Blanchards of 1934. Which is now hanging in the Musée Picasso in Paris. And problem, of course, apparently they are very far away, right? One from the other. But actually, if you look at the ambition of making masterpieces, of telling stories, of dealing with history, they are very close also in many ways.
Yes, yes. And as an art historian and the commissioner of the Balthus exhibition in Martigny, can you explain us something about the mystery Balthus as a sort of a conclusion, please?
That's a very difficult question. As I told you at the beginning, 20 years ago, Balthus refused any explanation either of his life or of his work. And afterwards, he agreed to people writing on his biography and on his work. And now, very little is unknown. We know almost everything of his life. We have a most precise feeling of the work, of the meaning of his work. So, but of course, the main question is, how can we judge today the importance of Balthus? Centenary of an artist is always a very difficult moment. Either you go into the purgatory, you accede to kind of a...
Next to God. In heaven.
Position, yes. And I hope he's now next to God.
And why is he a genius? Because you mentioned this before.
If I knew. No, 30 years ago, when the first large retrospectives of Balthus works were made in France or in England, because there was a very large retrospective at the Tate Gallery in London 20 years ago, Balthus was still an enigma, because we could not figure out how he fit with the classical...
Movement of the
avant-garde in the 20th century. Nobody was known about his life. Nothing was known about his intellectual, cultural and spiritual origins. Now it's much easier to see that he is deeply involved in another story of the 20th century. But this story is just beginning to be written down. And it will be a story totally different from the Vulgate, I don't know how you say that, Vulgate, we have been accustomed to learn when we were at school.
So we can hope that there are still other faces of Balthus and of his work to be discovered in the future.
Oh yes, I'm sure of that.
Yes.
Absolutely.
But unfortunately, we have come to the end of our conversation. But a final question, where are most of Balthus' paintings to be found?
Well, I mentioned the Edinburgh National Gallery of Scotland, the Tate National Gallery, in London has many masterpieces of Balthus. In Paris, you have many works now in the collection of the Musée National d'Art Moderne Saint Pompidou. In America and the States, United States, were the first to buy important works of Balthus. You have a nice collection in the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Metropolitan Museum in New York, the Hirschhorn Museum in Washington. That's about all.
And also in France, in Amiens, in Troyes.
In the provinces in France, besides Paris, you have beautiful works in Amiens, in Troyes, in Lille. So plenty of places.
So, Jean-Claire, let me thank you so much for having offered the listeners of Canal Academy your precious time and your most illuminating comments on this highly unusual artistic figure of the 20th century. A reminder for our listeners, the Balthus retrospective, an event that cannot be ignored, taking place until the 23rd of November 2008 at the Pierre Janada Foundation in Martigny, Switzerland, the only institution in the world celebrating Balthus' century. Jean-Claire, thank you once again.
Thank you very much.
And I hope to see you soon for another talk about your own career.
I do hope so. Thank you very much.
Bye.